Well, we're all set up. So our Bible study, going through the Gospel according to John Mark, continues. Last week, I think we did chapters 3, 4, and 5. So today, we'll pick up in chapter 6 and just see how far we can get. Of course, the great temptation is to go into numerous tangents and so on and so forth, take a long time to get through it, which is a temptation I do sometimes succumb to. But I'll try and move on as quickly as I can, because, you know, John Mark wrote a very fast-paced book, and it's probably a shame to take, you know, 3 years to go through 16 chapters. But beginning in chapter 6 and verse 1, then Jesus went out from there and came to his own country, and his disciples followed him. This is Jesus going back to basically his hometown of Nazareth, up in the Galilee region. Verse 2, and when the Sabbath had come, he began to teach in the synagogue. And many hearing him were astonished, saying, where did this man get these things? And what wisdom is this which is given to him, that such mighty works are performed by his hands? You know, these people in Jesus' own hometown were rather surprised by what Jesus was up to and his reputation. Verse 3, is this not the carpenter, the son of Mary, the brother of James and Joses and Judas and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us? And they were offended at him. So, you know, Jesus was back in his hometown, and they were saying, well, we know this guy. This is Jesus, the carpenter. The word carpenter means really a craftsman, and Jesus was obviously known by reputation in his hometown as being a craftsman, a man who'd grown up among them and had been involved perhaps in the carpentry business, or perhaps it could be the building business or working with stone. And they said, well, this is Jesus the craftsman. Isn't Mary his mother? You know, one of us? And what about his brothers? They work locally. There's James and Joses and Judas and Simon, and he's got sisters here. This is just an ordinary lad from our community. Who does he think he is? Almost as a question. And it says they were offended. They stumbled. They couldn't accept that this man from their own town, from their own midst, could possibly be anything other than just Jesus the carpenter. Interesting, doesn't mention there any reference to Joseph. So it looks quite likely that Joseph, excuse me, Jesus' stepfather, was probably by now, you know, dead and gone. Verse 4. But Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor, except in his own country, among his own relatives, and in his own house, his own household. And we know from other scriptures that Jesus' own family did not yet believe in him. Verse 5. Now, he could do no mighty work there, except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. Now that's quite an interesting verse in some ways. It says Jesus could do no mighty work there. It says he could do no miracle. It doesn't say he wouldn't. You know, Jesus has the same compassion, the same desire to assist, to heal, to bless, wherever he would go. And here he is in his own hometown, perhaps a particular affection for his own hometown, his own neighbors, people he grew up with. But it says he could do no mighty work there. He could do no miracle, except he laid his hands on a few, one translation says, sickly people, and healed them. Verse 6, and he marveled because of their unbelief. You know, Jesus was actually astonished that these people couldn't see the truth. They couldn't have faith in him. And he himself marveled at them. And the point was that without their faith, without their belief, you know, Jesus was actually handicapped. He couldn't really overrule their disbelief. Their hearts were hardened. They would not believe. And in the absence of their belief in him, there was nothing that Jesus, in a sense, could work with. They prevented him by their hard heart and by their unbelief from doing the things he would like to have done. If you hold your place there for a moment, just turn back to chapter 5, where we were last week, and verse 34. Remember the story of the lady that came behind Jesus in the crowd and pushed her way through, and said, "If I can just touch his garment, I will be healed." And she was. Verse 34, Jesus said to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and be healed of your affliction." You know, there was a need for faith to be there for this lady to be healed. And she had that faith. And her faith was demonstrated by her actions. And Jesus said, you know, your faith, the faith that you had in me, has brought about your healing. If we hold our place there and turn to the book of Matthew, chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9. And we'll pick up in verse 27 when we get there. Matthew 9, verse 27. When Jesus departed from there, two blind men followed him, crying out and saying, "Son of David, have mercy on us." And when he had come into the house, the blind men came to him. Not easy if you're blind. And Jesus said to them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" In other words, do you have faith? Or do you have unbelief? Like the people back in Nazareth. He says, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" And they said to him, "Yes, Lord." Then he touched their eyes, saying, "Okay, according to your faith, let it be to you." And their eyes were opened. So here's an example of two men who were completely blind. Probably had to be led by the hand to the house where Jesus was. And Jesus says, "Do you believe?" And they said, "Yes, Lord." And he said, "Okay, according to the level of your belief, let it be done unto you." And of course, their eyes were miraculously healed and they could see. And I'm sure there was great rejoicing in their families and among their friends that night. So Jesus makes it fairly plain that, you know, faith is something that he looks for, something he expects, something he can work with. Another scripture tells us without faith it is impossible to please God. But here's Jesus in his own hometown back in Mark chapter 6. And what did he discover? You know, verse 6, their unbelief was strong. So strong was their unbelief that Jesus himself was very much handicapped in what he could do. He needs people to have faith. You know, if you have faith, all things are possible, it says, to him who believes. But in the absence of that faith, you know, Jesus had difficulty in doing much apart from, you know, healing a few sickly people. But no major miracles, no particularly mighty works were done there. Carrying on verse 6, then he went about the villages in a circuit teaching. So there's perhaps a schedule, and Jesus went, you know, from town to town and village to village, teaching and preaching and healing. Verse 7. And he called the 12 to him and began to send them out two by two and gave them power or authority over unclean spirits. And Mr. Armstrong, I think, took this particular example as to why in the baptismal tours and so on of many years ago, he would send out the men two by two. Verse 8, he commanded them to take nothing for the journey except a staff, no bag, and that would be essentially a sort of beggar's bag. I think in those days people went out, you know, begging or tramps and so on, and even some itinerant preachers and so on would take out a bag and, you know, sort of bucket, shake it under your nose as you walk past and ask for a few dollars. And that's how, well, it still happens today, of course. There's many places you go in life where you come across somebody, you know, shaking a bucket or upturned hat or a box, trying to get some money off you. And so Jesus said, don't you do that. Don't take a bag. No bread, no copper in their money belts. That's no money. No silver dineros. But to wear sandals and not to put on two tunics. You know, don't get loaded up with extra gear. Don't take luxury items. Just go out basically in what you've got on and go off. And, take power over unclean spirits and teach and heal and so on. And in a sense, Jesus was giving them the opportunity to see if they could live by faith, because really, if somebody said to you or to me, okay, I'm sending you off on a mission, I want you to take certain parts of the truth, or some leaflets or booklets or magazines, and take them off, and I want you to go away for several weeks, oh, by the way, don't take any money. No credit cards either. Don't take anything, just off you go and do it. We'd be thinking about, just a moment, this is all very impractical. Where can I stay tonight? I need to get a hotel room, and I've got no credit card and no money. What about breakfast? I've got no food. How can I possibly live? This is ridiculous. But Jesus was, in a sense, making them practice living by faith, looking to God, their Father, as their provider. And more or less saying, you need to learn, lads, in a hurry, to look to your Heavenly Father as your God, as your provider, and learn to put trust in Him. In the future, you know, when I'm gone and so on, if you're always looking to me and my personal presence with you to bail you out and provide for you, I'll be gone. If you're always looking at the how much money you've got in your bank account before you decide to do certain things you won't accomplish. You need to step out and walk by faith and learn by experience that God will provide for you. And that was, of course, an important lesson for them to learn, and equally an important lesson for us to learn. If you hold your place there and turn to Matthew chapter 6, we'll just dip into the so-called Sermon on the Mount. Matthew 6, and starting verse 31. Jesus said to his disciples, "Therefore do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear?" And those are the sort of thoughts that could come to the mind when Jesus was sending them out with very little provision. "For after all these things the Gentiles seek, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you." You know, God's mathematics is to add to us and to multiply. You know, Satan is the one who comes to take away and to divide. And Jesus says here, look, you know, go God's way, be confident, put your trust in him. Don't worry about eating and drinking and clothing yourself. God knows you need all those things, and he will provide. Verse 34, "Therefore, do not worry or be anxious about tomorrow, for tomorrow will worry about its own things. Sufficient for the day is its own trouble." Okay, back to Mark. So Jesus had already made it plain in earlier teaching that they needed to look to God as their provider. And really, it's the same for us today. It's particularly hard sometimes for people who are humanly quite wealthy, and that might not apply to any of us, of course, but those who are wealthy, it's easy to trust in their wealth. You know, their bank account is stuffed full of, you know, dollar bills. They can live in a great big house, 2 or 3 swimming pools, 10 cars in the driveway, and so on. It's hard for that person to trust in God, because they put their trust in their physical, material, financial assets. But you and I, irrespective of whether we've got no money, a little money, or lots of money, need to realize that God is our provider, and we shouldn't be caught up worrying about physical things. We shouldn't look, if we're an employee and we work for an employer, then really our employer is not our provider. God is our provider. If our employer goes out of business, winds up the business, if we are fired, perhaps over Sabbath keeping or whatever it might be, God is our provider, not our employer. So, you know, Jesus was here making it really very plain by practical day after day experience that I'm sending you out with virtually nothing. You're going to have to learn, lads, to rely on God coming through and providing for you, and you'll have a wonderful experience. Verse 10, "Also he said to them, in whatever place you enter a house, stay there till you depart from that place. And whoever will not receive you nor hear you, when you depart from there, shake off the dust under your feet as a testimony against them. Assuredly, I say to you, it will be more tolerable for Sodom and Gomorrah in the day of judgment than for that city. So they were to go out, you know, come into a city, and really rely that God would make it possible for them to stay there. Somebody would come forward and offer them a room and a bed and breakfast and lunch and so on and so forth, and it would happen. And if they ever got to a place where they were just totally rejected, they would just move on out, just shake the dust off your feet, and move on to the next place. Verse 12, so they went out and preached that people should repent, and they cast out many demons and anointed with oil many who were sick and healed them. So this, I think, was their first tour on their own, going out, you know, two by two, and they were casting out demons. Those who were sick, they were anointing with oil. You know, Jesus often just touched people or spoke the word, but it looks like the disciples actually used oil to anoint them, and they were healed. And if you were, you know, one of the disciples, and you saw demons leaving people and sick people being healed, you would be, I think, extremely encouraged. And as you went from town to town and people sort of miraculously opened up their home to you and fed you and so on and so forth, you would think, there is a God in heaven, I'm part of his work, and I can just see day by day these many miracles showing that God's working with me. Okay, moving on to verse 14. So Jesus, you know, obviously is getting more and more well known. Excuse me, verse 14. Now King Herod heard of him, Jesus, for his name had become well known. And he said, oh, John the Baptist is risen from the dead, and therefore these powers are at work in him. So King Herod had reason to believe that this miracle worker was none other than the resurrected John Baptist. Others said, it is Elijah. Others said, it is the prophet, or like one of the prophets. But when Herod heard, he said, no, this is John, whom I beheaded. He has been raised from the dead. So Herod had been up to, you know, some rather bad work again. For Herod himself had sent and laid hold of John and bound him in prison for the sake of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, for he had married her. So Herodias was the wife of Philip, but Herod had convinced her to leave Philip and marry him. And we know from history that Herod had put his own wife away so that he could marry Philip's wife. It's a bit confusing. It's almost like today's celebrity news, all these various husbands and wives are coming in and going and so on. But John had said to Herod, it is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. You know, it is contrary to the law. You are wrong. You are in major error, Mr. Herod. And so therefore, you know, Herod was rather unhappy. He was a man who was, you know, a despot, a dictator, arrogant. And so he had sent, arrested John Baptist, and he was in prison at this time. But verse 19, Herodias held it against him and wanted to kill him, but she could not. So, you know, the old saying, you know, what women are like when they're scorned, hell hath no fury. And here's Herodias, who is being publicly shamed, as she sees it, you know, by John Baptist's public announcements. And Herodias, having plenty of fury and this great grudge, wants to kill John Baptist. But how's she going to accomplish that? You know, he's in prison and he's under, if you like, state protection. Verse 20, for Herod feared John, knowing that he was a just and holy man, and he protected him. And when he heard him, he did many things and heard him gladly. So, you know, Herod was perhaps a bit confused in his own mind. He hated the way John Baptist, you know, told on him in public. He hated the way he was criticized for living in adultery with Herodias. But on the other hand, John Baptist was a great man, an inspiring man to listen to, a man whose words were full of wisdom, and you know, Herod heard his words gladly and protected him probably against Herodias, but didn't quite know what to do with him, really. Verse 21, then an opportune day came, for Herodias, really, when Herod, on his birthday, gave a feast for his nobles, the high officers, and the chief men of Galilee. And when Herodias' daughter herself came in and danced, and pleased Herod and those who sat with him, the king said to the girl, "Ask me whatever you want, and I will give it to you." He also swore to her, "Whatever you ask me, I will give you up to half of my kingdom." So you have to use your imagination a wee bit here, I think, after what sort of dancing this young lady had been doing to get a sort of a drunken Herod so infatuated that he was willing to give up half his kingdom for the young lady. Mr. Ted Armstrong, I always believed that the reference there was to Herod wanting to dump Herodias and probably marry the daughter so that half the kingdom would be her right as his new wife. And one can only imagine that the dancing here for Herod's birthday, when they were all, you know, supping adequate amounts of wine and so on, was probably quite a licentious type of dance, perhaps a scantily clad, and had inflamed the passions of Herod. And so in his drunken, lecherous state, he pretty much said, "I'll give you half the kingdom," nudge, nudge, wink, wink. And she would know that means, "Oh, you're going to get rid of my mum, and I'm going to become the queen." And, that's quite an offer. Josephus, the Jewish historian, says that this young lady's name was Salome. Doesn't tell us in the Bible, but that looks to be the case. So this was Salome, daughter of Herodias, and had been no doubt sent in by Herodias to probably try to appeal to Herod. Anyway, he offers her anything she wants. Verse 24, "So she went out and said to her mother, 'What shall I ask?' And her mother said, 'The head of John the Baptist.'" You know, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. She's going to get her chance now. "Immediately," as Mark likes to use that term, "she came in with haste to the king and asked, saying, 'I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter.'" You know, and of course, immediately, Herod probably sobered up and regretted what he'd said. "And the king was exceedingly sorry. Yet, because of the oaths and because of those who sat with him, he did not want to refuse her. And immediately the king sent an executioner and commanded his head to be brought. And he went and beheaded him in prison, brought his head on a platter, and gave it to the girl. And the girl gave it to her mother." Quite a bloody sight, I would have thought. "And when the disciples heard of it," that's John's, "they came and took away his corpse and laid it in a tomb." So a sort of sad end, in a sense, for John Baptist, you know, a man sent by God, preaching repentance to people and baptizing many people, and a woman was his downfall, because Herodias was so hated him for his comments about her, that she just nursed this hatred and jealousy and sought her revenge. And here comes Herod in a no doubt inebriated state, making some utterly stupid comments with his mouth, and it ends up, you know, a man of God loses his life because of the a woman. And it is a excuse me, a good example, in a sense, here of the danger of not sometimes watching our mouths, because sometimes the things that we say can have quite serious consequences, as Herod found out here to his cost, and as John Baptist, you know, found out to his cost. If we just keep our place there and turn to Proverbs chapter 13 for a moment. Proverbs 13. The book of Proverbs, of course, is filled with practical wisdom, and one of the areas it does cover quite a lot of is being careful to engage our brain before we open our mouth and start rattling away. Proverbs 13 and verse 3, we're told, "He who guards his mouth preserves his life, but he who opens wide his lips shall have destruction." So the instruction really is, look, be careful what you do with your big mouth. You know, if you keep control of your mouth, if you're careful about what you say and to whom you say it, you can preserve, protect, safeguard your own life. But if you're prone to opening it up and just letting it all hang out, he who opens wide his lips shall have destruction. And in the case of, you know, Herod, you know, he was later on destroyed. I think he ended his life in misery and poverty. But it's a good piece of advice in the book of Proverbs here that you and I, our tongues, our mouths can get us into trouble, just like Herod got him into trouble. So like the proverb says, let's be careful what we say, to whom we say it, and if you open your mouth too wide, too often, you will get into trouble. Turning to Proverbs chapter 21, let's have one more proverb. Proverbs 21, and I think it's verse 23. Whoever guards his mouth and tongue keeps his soul from troubles. And like I say, there are many other illustrations there that you need to guard your mouth and guard your tongue. And that's advice for Herod. It's advice for you and me today. It's advice for our youngsters. Watch your mouth. Watch your tongue. It can get you into trouble. I mean, there are people, for example, who have a rather short temper. You know, something riles them up, and what happens? Straight away, they open their mouth and blast out, I'm going to give that person a piece of my mind. Well, of course, you know, that person doesn't really want a piece of your mind. You know, God doesn't want a piece of your mind. I mean, our minds, for the most part, aren't particularly full of good things. And dumping, you know, your great opinions and impressions on some unsuspecting person is of no good to them, frankly, or to us. So a short temper that results in a blast of unguarded statements is a problem. And of course, another danger area, I have to say, is the influence of alcohol. Because, you know, I've seen situations, we probably all have, where somebody's had just a wee bit too much alcohol, and what happens? Their tongue starts flapping, the mouth starts opening and closing, and out comes a whole host of things. Sometimes garbled, sometimes true, but said in an inappropriate manner to the wrong person. I know some years back, during one of the feasts, one of the feast days, those are the days when alcohol was available at the feasts, and you know, one man in our congregation did definitely drink altogether too much. Now, not to the point that he was falling over and lying flat on his face on the floor of the meeting room. He looked okay from a distance, looked okay actually close up, but when he started talking, his tongue was rather loose, and he had a grudge or two against the minister, I recollect, at that time. And, you know, most Sabbaths he would say nothing to the minister apart from, nice to see you, you're looking well, and so on. But this holy day, with the benefit of alcohol flowing through his veins, he took the opportunity to tell the minister precisely what he thought of him and his messages and his way of life and his kids and everything else. Memory's a little bit sort of unclear, but I think it was just after that alcohol was cancelled at all future holy days, because the minister obviously thought, you know, after he'd got over his amazement, that alcohol is being put to rather bad use in this congregation. People can't control the drinking, and when they can't control the drinking, they can't control their tongue, and all manner of things are said that are best left unsaid. The person, you know, did not guard his tongue. He didn't guard his lips. Okay, back to Mark chapter 6. So that's goodbye to John the Baptist in rather unpleasant circumstances. Cherche la femme, I think they say. Verse 30. Then the apostles gathered to Jesus. Remember, they'd been sent out two by two on their mission, and told him all things, both what they had done and what they had taught. So they were, I guess, pretty excited to come back and say, hey, Jesus, these are the things that we did, and this is where we went, and this is what we said, and this is how they treated us, and so on and so forth, and all very exciting. And he said to them, come aside by yourselves to a deserted place, a secluded place, and rest a while, for there were many coming and going, and they did not even have time to eat. And this is a very busy period. A parallel passage explains that it was Passover time, and Passover time was, like most of the holy days, was very, very busy. There were many hundreds of thousands. I think some historians say there were the best part of 1 or 2 million extra people arrived in the land of Israel for the feast days to keep them. So, you know, here's, you know, Jesus and the disciples trying to get a little bit of a break. But of course, the whole countryside is thronging with all these extra bodies who are turning up to keep the feast days. And like I've said before, you know, it is important for us to get adequate rest. And I've mentioned before, I think, a number of times, you know, the example of the minister from some decades ago who was ordained way back in the 1950s and served in Pasadena as a very busy man, but he ran him so ragged, looking after the brethren and helping them and doing good things. There's no question that the man was working hard, you know, for the Lord. And he really extended himself and stretched himself, but he never allowed adequate time, it seems, in his schedule for a bit of a break, a bit of rest, and he burnt himself out. It took him quite some time to recover. And so Jesus was a bit more sharp, knew the needs of himself and his team. He said, look, lads, we need to get away from here for a while because it's just so hectic. There's just no time even to, you know, sit down and have a quiet meal together. Come on, let's get out of here. Verse 32. So they departed to a deserted place in the boat by themselves. And took his offer up straight away. Unfortunately, others were around. Verse 33. But the multitudes saw them departing, and many knew him, you know, recognized Jesus, and ran there on foot from all the cities. They arrived before them and came together to him. So Jesus got in a boat with his team, sailed perhaps not too far. The Sea of Galilee is not a very big lake, and at this part it's probably only 3 or 4 miles across, I guess. So, but they thought they were going to escape for a while to a sort of secluded area where they could have some privacy. But then they arrived, they were met on the shore by all these people that had run round the top of the lake. And Jesus, when he came out, saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them, because they were like sheep not having a shepherd. So he began to teach them many things. So Jesus, you know, he couldn't turn away. He thought they were going to get a quiet moment, but steps off the boat and there's, you know, several thousand people just looking at him and waiting for something from him. And Jesus is just moved out of compassion. His heart just yearns within him, because, you know, these poor people, they don't know. They don't know the truth. They're lost sheep. They're sort of confused by what is right and what is wrong. And he began to teach them. Verse 35. And when the day was now far spent, a bit like it is here in England at the moment, you know, darkness is descending upon us, his disciples came to him and said, this is a deserted place, and already the hour is late. Send them away, that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat. You know, they could look around and think, well, these folk have got no sandwiches. They've got no flasks of coffee. There's nothing here. These folk, they're going to be hungry. It's going to be dark soon. But he answered and said to them, you give them something to eat. And they said to him, huh? Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give them something to eat? But he said to them, how many loaves do you have? Go and see. And when they found out, they said, well, five loaves and two fish, which obviously is not enough to feed, you know, a few dozen people. Then he commanded them to make them all sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in ranks, in hundreds and fifties. Oh, there's quite a lot of them then. And when he had taken the five loaves and the two fish, he looked up to heaven, blessed, and broke the loaves, and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And the two fish he divided among them all. Well, they can't have got much each, can they? Just two fish. So they all ate and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets full of fragments and of the fish. Well, that's, of course, far more than they started with, after everybody had eaten. Now, those who had eaten the loaves were about 5,000 men. That's a lot of people. And in the book of Matthew, it tells us it was 5,000 men besides women and children. So they were extra to the 5,000. So how many there were in total, your guess is as good as mine. It's quite likely, I would have thought, there'd be maybe 10,000 altogether, because there'd be lots of wives there, perhaps some single ladies and children, perhaps one or two children per family, who knows. But 5,000 men plus women and children, so you're looking at 10,000, maybe, 12,000, 15,000. You've got a small town out there in the countryside, all being fed from five loaves and two fish. An amazing miracle of Jesus just multiplies natural resources in an incredible manner. Now, you would have thought, surely, the disciples, as they keep walking around, giving somebody a bit of fish and then somebody else a bit of fish and then going back and a bit more fish, and hang on a second, I've just fed 25 people with fish and some bread, and there wasn't that much to start with. And they must have looked around and just thought, hey, this is amazing. There's endless supplies here of fish and bread. And then when they finished, they took up, like it says, umpteen baskets full of leftovers. Far more leftover after feeding 10, 12,000 people than they started with. An astonishing miracle. Verse 45. Immediately, he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent them away, he departed to the mountain to pray. Jesus was pretty busy himself, wasn't he? But he found time, made time, created time to pray. And if Jesus, the Messiah, needs to find time to pray, then of course, so do you and I. And it might be busy in our lives on occasions, but Jesus found the time to pray. Verse 47. Now when evening came, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he was alone on the land. Then he saw them straining at rowing, for the wind was against them. So they were rowing the boat, but obviously their faces were pretty red and puffed, and the strong wind blowing, and perhaps they were getting absolutely nowhere. And about the fourth watch of the night, that would be around about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, he came to them, walking on the sea, whoops, amazing, and would have passed them by. Not quite sure why Jesus was walking past them. Perhaps he just thought, well, they're making no progress. Be quicker to walk on myself, and I'll be at the far end long before them. But when they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed it was a ghost, a spirit of some sort, and cried out. The Greek implies they shrieked in terror. These were strong fishermen and all that sort of stuff, but you've been puffing and blowing for hours and hours trying to get across this lake. The wind's blowing in your face for hours and hours, which should have been a fairly simple journey, or perhaps 1 or 2 hours. 9 hours later, you're still getting nowhere. And then this ghostly figure comes walking past, out in the lake somewhere. So they shrieked out in terror, for they all saw him and were troubled. And immediately, he talked with them and said to them, "Be of good cheer," or, "take courage. It is I. Do not be afraid." Then he went up into the boat to them, and the wind ceased. So as soon as Jesus got into the boat, the wind stopped. And they were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure and marveled, for they had not understood about the loaves, because their heart was hardened. This was only a few hours after Jesus had multiplied fish and bread to feed 10,000 or more people. It was obvious that Jesus had got remarkable power over nature, and he was Jesus walking in water and quietening the wind. You would have thought surely by now they realized that Jesus could do anything virtually with nature, but they hadn't got the message yet. The penny had not yet dropped. Verse 53. When they had crossed over, they came to the land of Gennesaret and anchored there. And when they came out of the boat, immediately the people recognized him. So you just could not get away no matter where you went, it seems. Ran through that whole surrounding region and began to carry about on beds those who were sick, to wherever they heard he was. Wherever he entered, into villages, cities, or the country, no matter wherever Jesus went, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and begged him that they might just touch the border of his garment. and as many as touched him were made well. Now, I wonder where they got to know about touching the border of Jesus' garment. Well, of course, it only happened a few days before, and the story, I guess, of the lady with the issue of blood touching Jesus' garment was now, you know, popular knowledge, so they all wanted to do the same. If I can touch his garment, then too, I will be healed just like she was. And you can see that the problem that Jesus and the disciples had was, literally, they could go nowhere. Everywhere they turned, you know, the paparazzi were there. It was impossible, it seemed, to escape. Okay, moving on to chapter 7. Then the Pharisees and some of the scribes came together to him, having come from Jerusalem. Now, when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled, that is, with unwashed hands, they found fault. They were good at that, of course, the Pharisees. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands in a special way, holding the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, with a touched riffraff and so on, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other things which they have received and hold, like the washing of cups, pitchers, copper vessels, and couches. Then the Pharisees and scribes asked him, "Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands?" And it's not a criticism that they were just not washing their hands, because, you know, simple hygiene is that before you would prepare food or eat food, you would wash your hands so they're clean. And this wasn't the issue to them. The issue was that the special ceremonial ritual washing of your hands and utensils wasn't being carried out, and therefore, as far as the Pharisees were concerned, you were defiling yourself. You were contaminating yourself. You were making yourself spiritually unclean because you were not washing in the correct manner. You were not ritually clean. You were, in fact, ritually unclean. You were defiled. And, of course, it was one of the many hundreds of rules and regulations the Pharisees had produced, passed down from father to son for generation after generation, the so-called tradition of the elders, which Jesus, you know, had no patience with. Verse 6, he answered and said to them, "Well, did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites?" Now, that's not the way to win friends and influence people, to say that you are a bunch of hypocrites. You are pretenders. You are not what you suggest you are. As it is written, and this is what Isaiah had written, and Jesus applies it to these so-called religious leaders, "This people honors me with their lips." You know, they say the right things, but their heart is far from me, and in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. And of course, there's an awful lot in those two verses there, but notice that Jesus says, quoting Isaiah, that you can worship Jesus in vain. In vain they worship me. They do worship me, but it's pointless. It's purposeless. It achieves nothing because they teach as doctrines not the commandments of God, but the commandments of men. And that, frankly, is totally irrelevant. If you hold your place there for a moment and turn to Matthew chapter 7, Matthew chapter 7, and verse 21, Matthew 7:21, we read here, "Not everyone who says to me, 'Lord, Lord,' shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven." So, you know, worshipping Jesus, Jesus is my Lord, I am a Christian. Jesus says, no, not everybody that says, "Lord, Lord," is going to be in the kingdom, but those that actually keep God's will or commandments. "Many will say to me in that day, 'Lord, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name? Cast out demons in your name? Done many wonders in your name?' And then I will declare to them, 'I never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness.' you who live contrary to the law, to the commandments. So Jesus makes it very plain even here in Matthew that just calling him Lord is of no relevance whatsoever. You can worship Jesus in vain. Back to Mark chapter 7 and verse 8. Jesus continues here to really berate the hypocrites that he was looking at for laying aside the commandment of God. Ooh, now that's quite an allegation, but Jesus is speaking the truth. He says, you actually put to one side the commandment of God and you hold the tradition of men, the washing of pitchers and cups and many other such things you do. And he said to them, all too well you reject the commandment of God, that you may keep your tradition. You know, these men purported to be leaders of the people, but Jesus said, you put your ideas forward, your traditions, and in doing so you actually push out, overturn and reject, as it says here, you reject God's commandments. For Moses said, verse 10, honor your father and your mother, and he who curses father or mother, let him be put to death. But you say, if a man says to his father or mother, whatever profit you might have received from me is korban, that is, dedicated to the temple, and you no longer let him do anything for his father or his mother, making the word of God of no effect through your tradition, which you have handed down. And many such things you do. That was just one illustration that, you know, these people would say, oh, I'm sorry, mom and dad, I know you're struggling a bit now in your older age, but sorry, can't help you out. All the money I've got is dedicated to God, to the temple. It's korban. Of course, the cunning thing was that they could use it themselves. So it was all just a contrivance not to look after their elderly parents. And Jesus said, that's disgusting. You know, you're making your tradition of more importance than the plain, simple commands of God. And there's many things you do like that. Verse 14. And when he had called all the multitude to him, he said to them, hear me, everyone, and understand. This is back now to the question about, you know, washing in this ritualistic manner. There is nothing that enters a man from outside which can defile him. You know, if you pick up a cup or a knife and there's some small bit of, you know, material on it, some sort of bit of dirt or insect's leg or something, that cannot defile you. But the things which come out of him, those are the things that defile a man. If anyone has ears to hear, let him hear. And that was the parable. And when he'd entered the house, away from the crowd, his disciples asked him concerning the parable. So they did not understand it. So he said to them, are you thus without understanding also? I mean, I think Jesus was just getting a bit occasionally exasperated that these guys have been with him for quite a long time. He says, what? I mean, you don't understand it either. Do you not perceive that whatever enters a man from outside cannot defile him? Now, you can't contaminate somebody's mind because there's a spider leg, you know, in the bowl of soup you've just drunk. Because it does not enter his heart, but his stomach, and is eliminated, thus purifying all foods. I think the King James Version says purifying meats. And some people try to state this as Jesus suddenly making, you know, pork and shrimp and snake suddenly into clean meats. But it's really talking about foods generally, that no food is able to contaminate your mind. And he said, what comes out of a man, that defiles a man, for from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders, thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, which is, you know, complete sexual immorality, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness. All these things come from within and defile a man. So the point was rather obvious, that whatever you eat just goes into your belly and through the intestines, and that's at the end of it. That doesn't harm your mind in any way. It's the evil thoughts we have. That's what contaminates and defiles us. Moving on to verse 24. And from there he arose and went to the region of Tyre and Sidon. That's, I think, actually outside of the territory of Israel. So I guess Jesus was trying to get really away from it all now and just get some of this much needed peace and quiet for himself and his disciples. And he entered a house and wanted no one to know it. But he could not be hidden. So even outside the territory, you know, back and beyond, so to speak, he's still spotted by somebody. It seems, thankfully, only perhaps one person here. For a woman whose young daughter had an unclean spirit heard about him, and she came and fell at his feet. The woman was a Greek, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she kept asking him to cast the demon out of her daughter. So, you know, she's not an Israelite, not a Jew. She's a Greek or a Syrophoenician, so definitely a Gentile lady, and she has a real need. You know, her little daughter is being demonized, and she knows Jesus. She's heard about the stories of him and so on, and she recognizes somehow who he is in this house, trying to be private and so on, and she just goes over and hurls him down and says, you know, please, you know, heal my little daughter. But Jesus said to her, let the children be filled first, for it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the little dogs. So he was saying, nope, sorry lady, no can do. You know, the bread is for the children, not for little dogs. And because as a Gentile, you know, this lady had really no right. She did not have a covenant with the God of Israel. There was really no legal right for her to receive anything. If you keep your place there for a moment, just turn to Ephesians chapter 2. And we'll just read verses 11 and 12. We read here, Paul's writing to a Gentile church in Ephesus, and Paul writes, therefore remember that you, once Gentiles in the flesh, who are called uncircumcision by what is called the circumcision made in flesh by hands, that at that time you were without Christ, being aliens from the commonwealth of Israel and strangers from the covenants of promise, having no hope and without God in the world. You know, as Gentiles, they were strangers from the covenants. You know, the God was not their healer. That belonged to the covenant that Jesus had made with his people Israel, his chosen people. And so they were strangers from that covenant. They were aliens from the commonwealth of Israel. They had no rights at all. And Jesus had earlier said to his disciples, go not into the way of the Gentiles. Don't go there. Go instead only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So, verse 27, back in Mark chapter 7, Jesus said, sorry, lady, you know, can't do it. The bread's for the children, can't throw it to little dogs. But verse 28, you know, she jumped really at that in a sense. She answered and said to him, yes, Lord, I don't disagree with that. Yet even the little dogs under the table eat from the children's crumbs. So, you know, she was fast. And I guess as even took, you know, Jesus' breath away there, you know, she almost she saw the hope straight away that, yeah, okay then, okay, you can't give the bread to the little dogs, but Lord, even little dogs can pick up the crumbs under the table. And then he said to her, okay then, for this saying, go your way, the demon has gone out of your daughter. And in Matthew's version it says, he says to her, great is your faith. Because really the lady had great faith. She knew that Jesus could heal and would heal if she could just convince him. And she said, okay, you know, the children's bread is healing. That's pretty much what it implies. And that healing is for the children. But okay, yeah, a little crumb, you can have that. It's all yours because, you know, you're showing great faith. And so, verse 30, when she'd come to her house, she found the demon gone out and her daughter lying in the bed, obviously sleeping or recovering. So good example. And that's the only time I think where Jesus ever actually initially refused to heal anybody. But once she persisted and showed Jesus her faith was strong, you know, Jesus responded in compassion as frankly he always did. And he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. Verse 31, and again, departing from the region of Tyre and Sidon, he came through the midst of the region of Decapolis to the Sea of Galilee. Then they brought to him one who was deaf and had an impediment in his speech, and they begged him to put his hand on him, obviously to heal him. So I think he could speak, but not obviously very well, some sort of impediment in his ability to speak. Verse 33, and he took him aside from the multitude, put his fingers in his ears, and he spat, and touched his tongue. I mean, fancy Jesus spitting. Unusual, some parts of the world you could be arrested if you were seen spitting. But here's the Messiah himself, takes this guy out away from the crowd, puts his fingers in the man's ears, then he spits, I assume spits on the ground, doesn't say for sure, and touched the man's tongue. Then, looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephatha, that is, be opened. Immediately, his ears were opened, and the impediment of his tongue was loosed, and he spoke plainly, no longer stumbling in his speech. Then he commanded them that they should tell no one, because the last thing Jesus wants is more publicity. But the more he commanded them, the more widely they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He makes both the deaf to hear and the mute to speak. Thinking about it, that's another great miracle. A man who is deaf suddenly can hear perfectly, can hear the birds up in the trees, can hear the sort of wind in the trees, and hear the thunder in the distance and so on, and his ability to speak restored. Moving on to chapter 8, which hopefully we'll race through. Verse 1, chapter 8. In those days, the multitude being very great, yet again, and having nothing to eat, Jesus called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the multitude, because they have now been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their own houses, they will faint on the way, for some of them have come from afar. So it was quite interesting that, you know, a large number of people, we find out how large in a few verses, have been with Jesus, for he says, you know, 3 days now. And it's time really that they got back to their homes, but the journey would probably leave some of them, you know, fainting by the wayside. Then his disciples answered him, well, how can one satisfy these people with bread here in the wilderness? He asked them, how many loaves do you have? And they said, 7. And he commanded the multitude to sit down on the ground. And he took the 7 loaves and gave thanks, broke them, and gave them to his disciples to set before them. And they set them before the multitude, and did a few small fish. And having blessed them, he said to set them also before them. So they ate and were filled, and they took up 7 large baskets of leftover fragments. Now those who had eaten were about 4,000. And Matthew's version says, besides women and children. So again, your guess is as good as mine, but was it 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 9,000 altogether? Quite a lot anyway. And then Jesus sent them away. So here's another example of Jesus feeding people not only spiritually, but also physically. You know, Jesus has compassion on people, and he's no different today than he was then. He's as interested today in our well-being as he was then. And immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and came to the region of Dalmanutha. And here come the Pharisees again, verse 11. And the Pharisees came out, and of course they're always looking for some dispute, some argument. They really hate Jesus vehemently, and he's not exactly impressed, frankly, with their way of life either. Matthew 23, we won't turn there, but that contains a whole section of Jesus' criticism and virtual condemnation of the Pharisees and their whole approach. But here they come again, and they began to dispute with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven, testing him. Verse 12, but he sighed deeply in his spirit. I mean, this really, you know, this troubled Jesus in a sense that when you faced up to these people, they really were so bad, so much in a sense of evil and hostility in them. And he just sighed deeply, you know, troubled in his spirit, and said, why does this generation seek a sign? I mean, I've seen a million already. Assuredly, I say to you, no sign shall be given to this generation. Although in Matthew 12, we know that Jesus said, apart from the sign of Jonas, the 3 days and three nights sign. Verse 13, and he left them, and getting into the boat again, departed to the other side. So he spent not much more time with the Pharisees, and really just took off again, I guess the opposite direction from them. Verse 14. Now the disciples had forgotten to take bread, and they did not have more than one loaf with them in the boat. Then he charged them, saying, obviously his mind still reflecting over his most recent dispute with the Pharisees, he says, take heed, beware, be on your guard, really, men, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the leaven of Herod. So he says, you know, you need to be very careful about the leaven of the Pharisees. And don't forget, he just disputed with them about a sign. He had argued with them about defiling yourself with unwashed hands. And he sort of pointed out just how hypocritical they were. And now he says, you know, look, men, be very careful. Be extremely careful about the leaven of these men. So they reasoned among themselves, saying, oh, it's because we have no bread. You know, bright to the end, it seems, the disciples. And Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, why do you reason because you have no bread? Do you not yet perceive nor understand? He shakes his head. Is your heart still hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? Having ears, don't you hear? Don't you remember? When I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments did you take up? They said 12. When I broke the 7 for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of fragments did you take up? And they said 7. So he said to them, how is it you do not understand? You know, Jesus is frankly, like, he's just astonished. How, after all the things they have seen and heard and witnessed, could they still not grasp the point? Behold a place there and turn to Matthew 16, verse 12. We can say they did actually get the point at the end. But they weren't particularly sharp. They were indeed really dull of hearing. Matthew 16, verse 12. Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. It was the teaching of the Pharisees that he was warning them about, not the bread you might buy from a Pharisee's bakery somewhere. Okay, back to Mark chapter 8. Now, if you look through that passage again, you can sort of sense Jesus shaking his head and just, like I say, his frustration with his men, because these were his top team. These were the men that had been with him out in the hills and the valleys and by the lake and in the boat. They had witnessed, you know, miracle after miracle. You know, people blind having their sight back, people deaf having their hearing restored. They'd seen him walking in water. He'd fed thousands of people. And it's actually, if you read it, there's actually 9 questions that Jesus asked them, just firing off rapidly one after another. You know, why do you reason? Question 1, don't you perceive and understand? Question 2, is your heart still hardened? That's 3. Having eyes, don't you see? That's 4. Having ears, don't you hear? That's 5. Don't you remember? Question 6. How many loaves? Question 7. How many more loaves? 8. And why don't you understand? 9. You know, 9 questions. Bang, 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 bang. And I think that implies that, you know, these guys just weren't as sharp as they ought to be. And of course, you have to think, well, then again, here we are today, and probably in many ways we have more opportunity than the disciples, because we've got the word in writing. We can read it again and again and again. We've got God's Holy Spirit. We've got a great legacy of truth handed down to us. Is it possible that with all of the stuff that's been given to us, that we too could end up as dull of hearing as these guys were at this point of their calling? And so I guess before we point too many fingers, we were to make sure that we ourselves understand the truth and respect it and are taking action. It's not the hearers, after all, but the doers are the ones who are blessed. Moving on to verse 22. Then he came to Bethsaida, and they brought a blind man to him, because he wouldn't be able to walk very easily, not knowing where he was going, and begged him to touch him. So he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the town. And when he had spit on his eyes, unhygienic. When he had spit on his eyes and put his hands on him, he asked him if he saw anything. I mean, this is, like I said earlier, I mean, Jesus spat somewhere with the other man who was, you know, deaf and had a speech impediment. He may have spat in the ground or spat somewhere else. It doesn't tell us, but here it tells us quite plainly that this man who was blind, Jesus spat on his eyes, which is like, that wouldn't go down too well in some of the posher parts of town. But Jesus spat in his eyes, put his hands on him, and asked him if he saw anything. And he looked up and said, well, I see men like trees walking. So it looks like he wasn't born blind, because he knew what men looked like and he knew what trees looked like. So I guess his blindness had arrived at, you know, some later time in his life. Then he put his hands in his eyes again and made him look up. And he was restored and saw everyone clearly. And he sent him away to his house, saying, neither go into the town nor tell anyone in the town. It's the last thing, again, is one is more publicity. And you might think, well, why would Jesus spit in somebody's eyes? It's not the way we would do it. It's spitting in the ground and spitting people's eyes. There's another example later on of Jesus using a spit bowl for another blind man. But it's like, I mean, that's odd, isn't it? It's not the sort of thing that you and I would think of as the right way to do things. But it reminds me of 1 Corinthians chapter 1. It's quite a good illustration of how God knows better than we do. 1 Corinthians chapter 1. Could we probably say this is foolishness, isn't it? To spit in somebody's eyes is downright disgusting thinking about it. But notice 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verse 25. It says, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. You know, we would say it's foolish, but frankly, God's foolishness, it works, because this guy was seeing clearly after having his eyes spat upon. And again, you can think of the example of Naaman, the Syrian leper from in the Old Testament. You know, Naaman have got leprosy, Naaman the leper, and he comes along to Elisha, and he wants Elisha to, you know, pull out all the stops and heal him of his nasty disease. And Elisha doesn't even bother coming out of his house. Just sends a messenger and says, go jump in the river. But make sure it's the River Jordan, and make sure you jump in it seven times. And of course, you know, Naaman says, this is foolishness. This is ridiculous. I mean, this is, what, the Jordan? What a scummy river that is. I mean, what about the old proper rivers back in my home country? And it seemed like foolishness, you know, go jump in the river seven times. But foolishness or not, he was persuaded to go and jump in the river. And he went in and out and in and out. And the seventh time he came out of the water, his skin was transformed like a baby's. Beautifully pink and smooth and clean. No leprosy. So what does seem sometimes foolishness to us, if it's God's way, it'll work. And so we can't really criticize Jesus for making a man see clearly who had been blind for a number of years. Even we do think it's rather strange to our modern sensitivities. Verse 27. Now Jesus and his disciples went out to the towns of Caesarea Philippi, and on the road he asked the disciples, saying to them, who do men say that I am? And they answered, well, you know, some say that you're John the Baptist, and we know that Herod had said that, but some say that you're Elijah, and others that you're one of the prophets. He said to them, okay, but who do you say that I am? And Peter, who was so often the spokesman, who didn't always guard his mouth, answered and said to him, you are the Christ, which meant that you are the Messiah. You are the anointed one. Then he charged them that they should tell no one about him, i.e. that he was the Messiah. The time wasn't quite ready yet. And he began to teach them, so this was probably the first time that Jesus, like it says, began to tell them about what was really going to happen to him. Up to this time, perhaps, they were thinking about Jesus being crowned as a king or an emperor, and maybe in his government as he ruled over the land of Israel and kicked out the Romans and so on. But he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed. Ooh, perhaps that wasn't in their thinking. And after 3 days, rise again. He spoke this word openly, meaning that, you know, it was plain. It wasn't said to them in any sort of a fancy parable. He just said, look, lads, things are going to get pretty bad from now on. The hostility against me is going to multiply. Frankly, I'm going to be rejected by all the leaders of Judaism. And in fact, I'm going to be killed, murdered by them, but I'll rise again in 3 days. Now, Peter says, verse 32, Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. You know, Peter might have been doing this as a spokesman still, so perhaps all the disciples had the same idea, but Peter certainly was the one that took the action, and he took Jesus, one version says, took Jesus by the hand and led him away and said, Jesus, you cannot say things like that. What's got into you? This is insane. And so on. And began to rebuke Jesus. You know, this plan of yours, this intention of yours is horrific. It's wrong. You're in error. You must immediately change your mind and not go down that route. And of course, where were those thoughts coming from? But when he had turned around and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter, saying, get behind me, Satan, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men. So I guess that probably made Peter's ears curl a bit, because in front of the disciples, he was rebuked in turn for really acting on Satan's behalf. The last thing Satan wanted was for Jesus to go down this particular route. So, you know, Peter stepped out of line a little bit, hadn't guarded his mouth quite properly, and so on. Now verse 34. And when he had called the people to him, with his disciples also, he said to them, whoever desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. You know, it talks about taking up your cross and following me, and some people think that refers to just the heavy burdens we have to carry through life. Well, that's just the cross I've got to bear. But of course, as far as the disciples were concerned at this stage, you know, Jesus hadn't been crucified. They weren't perhaps expecting him to be crucified. And the cross to them was nothing other than just a stake on which you were nailed to death. It was where you put things to death, was on a cross or a stake, an upright pail or pole. And so when Jesus said, take up your cross, in the context of denying it, so it simply means, you know, put to death, you know, all the selfish thoughts you've got. Put to death all the weaknesses in your life. It doesn't mean just carry a heavy burden. You know, I've literally heard a man in the church say that his wife was the cross he had to bear, meaning that she was a real, you know, difficult woman, and that living his life with this monster, sharing his bed and so on, was the cross he had to bear. Well, no, it wasn't a cross he had to bear. It might have been a pretty difficult circumstance. Well, she probably said the same about him, I imagine. But the thing is that take up the cross means really, on a daily basis, put to death and execute all the weaknesses and the frailties and the corrupt parts of our lives. Deny ourselves. Deny himself. Deny to yourself all the selfish things you want to do. Put them to death. Because whoever desires to save his way of life, you know, his comforts, his selfish desires, will lose his life, and so on. Verse 36, for what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? You know, if you become a famous star celebrity, and you've got lots of money in the bank, and you occupy a huge house, and you've got other houses dotted around the countryside, and a fleet of cars and chauffeurs, and you've got lots of, you know, women throwing themselves at your feet, or perhaps men if you're a female, and the whole world is looking to you, if in doing that you've compromised, you know, your character, your integrity, your truth, you've sold out everything decent to get money and fame, it was a poor exchange, because you'll shortly die and that will be the end. Verse 37, what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words, in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him the Son of Man also will be ashamed when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. So Jesus talks about his future return. He hasn't even gone yet, of course. That might puzzle the disciples a wee bit. But he says, I'm coming again in glory with the holy angels. But frankly, he says, don't be ashamed of me. Don't be ashamed of my words. Don't be ashamed of the path of life I've got to follow. You know, Peter, certainly, and the disciples perhaps, had said to Jesus, you don't want to go down that way. Oh, you don't want to be murdered. You don't want to be opposed by the leaders. Oh, don't do that, Jesus. Oh, that's a shameful way to end up. She said, no, don't be ashamed of my way of life, what I stand for, or what's going to happen, because one day I'll return in glory, and then those who are with me and support me and share in that will themselves also, of course, be glorified. Okay, brethren, well, that I think should conclude for today. 3 chapters isn't too bad, and of course, next week we'll carry on again.